Hello, I'm Dr. Albert Rizzo, Chief Medical Officer of the American Lung Association. Welcome to Lungcast. In keeping with our effort to spotlight individuals and events in pulmonary history each month during our podcast, we have chosen an individual that incorporates that pulmonary aspect as well as a recognition of June as Pride Month. It would be difficult to find a more suitable topic than this, the introduction to the life and career of Alberta Lucile Hart, who became the physician and novelist Dr. Alan L. Hart. Alberta Lucile Hart was born on October 4, 1890, Hall Summit, Kansas, the only child of Albert and Edna Hart. As a child, Hart was assigned female at birth, but was allowed to dress and live as a boy, with both parents freely supporting the gender expression. Hart was considered a masculine child and identified more as a boy than as a girl. In 1908, Hart enrolled in Albany College, which is now known as Lewis and Clark College, then transferred to Stanford University in 1910. While there, Hart helped establish the first woman's debate club. Being exposed to the culture of San Francisco, Hart adopted tailored clothing and masculine habits. Hart then returned to Albany College and graduated in 1912. The following year, Hart enrolled at the University of Oregon Medical School, which is now the Oregon Health and Science University School of Medicine. Upon graduating in 1917, Hart was the first assigned woman to receive the Sailor Medal for achieving the highest standing in all departments of the school. It was during this time in medical school that Hart realized that attraction to women was considered abnormal by his contemporary society. According to psychiatrist J. Allen Gilbert, whom Hart consulted with, Hart was sexually attracted to women and often dressed in men's clothes. Ultimately, Hart married Inez Stark in California in February 1918, using the name Robert Allen Bamford, Jr. While undergoing therapy with Dr. Gilbert, Hart underwent a hysterectomy, then assumed the identity and clothes of a man. Hart identified himself as Alan L. Hart and began medical practice in Southwest Oregon at the Garnier Hospital. Passing as a man in the medical profession and literary circles for four decades involved a complicated life subjected to discrimination and led to numerous moves, job changes, and financial challenges. Hart had been driven from place to place, from job to job, for years because of something that could not be altered any more than eye coloring could be altered. Hart had difficulties getting full-time work and wrote, quote, "I am sure I would have done something rather desperate if I had not turned to writing," end quote. Fortunately, Hart did. The result was four novels with Northwest settings, published from 1935 to 1942, which constitute a significant body of social fiction and expose greed and prejudice in the medical profession. Each presents sympathetic portraits of underdogs seeking social justice and changes in the medical profession. His writing was progressive for its time and contained autobiographical themes that included medicine and sexuality. Hart's first novel, titled Dr. Mallory, is the story of an idealistic general practitioner in a small town in Oregon. It is based on Hart's own experience practicing medicine. He eventually wrote three other novels, The Lives of Men, The Undaunted, and Dr. Finley Sees It Through. Hart's novels received a fair amount of critical attention and were reviewed in the New York Times, the New York Herald Tribune, Saturday Review of Literature, and other leading publications of the times. Professionally, Hart began to focus more on research, going on to receive a master's degree in radiology in 1930 and another in public health in 1948. After years of trying to keep a low profile, in the late 1940s, Hart began taking newly available synthetic male hormones, which enabled the growth of a beard and the lowering of the voice sufficiently to give Hart the confidence to begin lecturing. Speaking nationwide on tuberculosis care, dedicating free time to fundraising for medical research, and supporting economically challenged TB patients, Hart strove to put an end to the stigma of the disease. With the public health background, Hart spearheaded massive X-ray programs for early detection and tubercular treatments, and was named the Director of Hospitalization and Rehabilitation of the Connecticut State Tuberculosis Commission. Alan Hart died from heart failure on July 1, 1962, in Hartford, Connecticut. Hart's contribution to medicine continues after his death at his old medical school. even though few people there have heard of Alan Hart. The residual of Hart's estate was left to the Medical Research Foundation, now Oregon Health Sciences Foundation. I believe Dr. Hart's story is a fitting addition to Pride Month, which is dedicated to celebrating the LGBTQ community and their struggle against discrimination and social ostracization. And now let's turn to today's medical and scientific topic. Given developments at legislative, academic, and societal levels in the last decade, this episode's topic is among the most discussed matters in respiratory health today. Electronic cigarettes, e-cigarettes, vape pens, the branded Juul device, however you know it, are a frequent subject of debate in a country which has steadily reduced its national combustible cigarette use in lieu of alternative nicotine delivery systems. Parameters of discussion surrounding e-cigarettes, from their branding and regulation to their effect on respiratory health, are still formulating. Researchers have pioneered investigation into their total effect and risks, while debate has contested their availability and marketing. As our guest, an expert himself in the matters of e-cigarette health, would say, there are still a lot of questions surrounding current e-cigarette use in the United States. The answers to such questions may inform their industry's future. Today we are joined by Dr. Kevin Walton, Chief of the Clinical Research Grants Branch at the NIH's National Institute on Drug Abuse. Dr. Walton's research background in the science of e-cigarettes and his expertise in addictive substances provides guidance for those trying to navigate the still-evolving field of vaping devices. Is it a safe cigarette alternative? What is the effect of device emissions? What research questions still persist? Dr. Walton answers these questions and more on this episode of Lungcast. Can you give us a brief history of the electronic nicotine delivery system evolution as it appeared in this country?
Sure. Yeah, I'd be glad to. And again, thank you very much for inviting me here. E-cigarettes, which is the common term, right, are also called electronic nicotine delivery systems. And I think, and just for terminology's sake, I think we generally use ENDS, the nicotine delivery system, in a scientific way, but certainly the common term is e-cigarette. And so they were first introduced in the US in about 2007. And those first devices were disposables. They were just single piece, you used them, and then you threw them away. And what we know now that we didn't know back then was that they're actually very poor at delivering nicotine to the user, and they were not very satisfying to users. And still, some people were in fact using them. And so, over time, they've gone through many different iterations, and they have many people refer to them as different generations. And so, the next version of the cigarette were these refillable devices. We had refillable cartridges, so the battery was separate from the cartridge, and they either were closed systems, which refers to the fact that they were sealed and you bought them filled, or they were open systems, which had a cartridge that you could fill up with purchased e-liquids. And then after that came what people call this third generation, which are these mods, which are bigger batteries and bigger tanks, and often had variable power, so you could basically control the heat, the level of heat that was used to aerosolize the e-liquid. And then most recently, it's what called are these pods, which are now, so we went through these large devices, and now they're actually very small devices. So an example of this would be Juul, where they look like thumb drives, and they're easy to just put in your pocket. They have small batteries, they have small cartridges, and these are also rechargeable. So many other devices are currently on the market. So for example, disposables are actually coming back, and now these new disposables are actually much more effective at delivering nicotine than the early ones. So just as an aside, my personal bias, it gets confusing when you talk about generations, because when you say disposable, what do you mean? The early ones you can't purchase anymore. and the new ones are actually much more effective. And one other issue that's very interesting about how these devices have evolved is that the nicotine, the chemistry of the nicotine has changed. And so you used to only be able to have a certain level of nicotine concentration, because if you would inhale it, it would be very sharp, and you really couldn't have a very high nicotine concentration because it'd be very aversive. And now they're using, many companies are using nicotine salts. So it's an ionized version. It's a slightly acidic pH, but it is not nearly as harsh. And so they're able to use much higher concentrations. So for example, in these smaller devices, they use high concentrations of these nicotine salts because they're not, the devices themselves is a small battery, so you can't have a lot of power delivering the nicotine, but when you have a high concentration of nicotine, you're actually able to deliver combustible cigarette-like levels of nicotine. So make this long story short, the devices went from being very poor delivering nicotine to now being able to deliver levels of nicotine very similar to combustible cigarette.
And I guess as a follow-up to that, that means that the amount of nicotine in many of these devices can vary across the device, the models, the brands, things of that nature?
Yes, they absolutely can. And that adds to the confusion, because you could have a device, you could have an e-liquid with a very low nicotine concentration, but a very strong battery, and that can deliver a lot of nicotine. And you could have a device with a high nicotine concentration and a weaker battery, and that could deliver the same amount of nicotine. So, you know, when people talk about what concentration of nicotine should be allowed in the e-liquids, it's not that simple a question. Really, what we care about is what does the device deliver.
And, you know, certainly as the Lung Association, when we've been talking about e-cigarettes, we really are concerned a lot about the health effects of the emissions, the role the nicotine's playing with regard to addiction potentials and things of that nature. Maybe can you talk a little bit about where the research is right now going on around nicotine and its role in that, and particularly the standardized cigarette, e-cigarette that I think NIDA is looking into?
I'd be happy to. So there's a lot of questions about current e-cigarette use. And I can get to those one of the biggest questions is e-cigarettes don't have the same level of toxicants that combustible cigarettes do. And so we characterize them is that they're less risky than combustible cigarettes. They're not safe. They are not, I wouldn't recommend anybody who doesn't smoke to use an e-cigarette. But adults who are cigarette smokers who are regular cigarette smokers who are addicted to nicotine, that might be a really good way for them. If they can't quit using FDA-approved medications, e-cigarettes can provide them a way to get away from the majority of the toxicants. And in a perfect world, would use an e-cigarette to help them get away from the worst effects of a combustible, and then get away from nicotine completely. But it could be a second step. But knowing that e-cigarettes have fewer toxicants, you might wonder, and now they can deliver the same level of nicotine as a combustible cigarette, why don't smokers just switch? And in fact, most smokers who use an e-cigarette are what we call dual users. They use both combustible cigarettes and e-cigarettes. They don't make the switch. And that's something we don't understand, and we would like to understand why, because an e-cigarette has many of the characteristics of a combustible cigarette. You inhale it, something put in your mouth, you hold it in your hand, it creates a throat hit that is an important part of the cigarette action, and it could create a cloud. And so it seems very similar to a combustible, and yet people don't switch. And so that's a big question, is trying to understand why that is. And if it's a less risky, it seems like a reasonable thing to do. So to get at that, we thought this is a project that was begun at NIDA really back in 2013. Myself and Dr. Aidan Hampson, who works with me at NIDA, came up with this idea to develop a standardized device. So there are hundreds of e-cigarettes out there and thousands of different e-liquids. And so it's very hard to figure out, you know, which one should researchers use to answer a certain question. And if one researcher uses one thing, a different researcher uses a different thing, different e-cigarette, how do you compare those results? And so if we had a standard device that was effective at delivering nicotine, that we knew it, you know, was very low in toxicants and was expected to be, you know, unchanged over many, many years. You know, clinical studies often take up to 5 years. And if your device changes over that time, it's sort of how do you interpret the data?
Right.
So so we have a standardized, so we've come out with this a standardized device. This is in through a contract mechanism with an e-cigarette company. And so they created this device that can be serve as a standard. It can serve with sort of two functions. One, researchers use it across different studies, then the studies are become comparable and you can really, you know, you can combine the data. And then it also can serve as a comparator to the commercial devices. And so if you know this, so it's called the standardized research e-cigarette, the SHREC. And if you can compare the commercial device to this research device, then that also gives you a way to compare across research studies. And we thought that because of the so many different devices out there and they all have different characteristics, that this would be a way to help move the science forward and provide some very basic data.
Right. Well, that's helpful. And I want to put my ALA hat on again. Just my advocacy team would be upset if I don't go back and reiterate some of the things you just mentioned about the fact that although we feel there are less toxicants in these devices, they are not considered safe. And also, you bring up the great point about the misinformation that these can be used as smoking cessation devices, which I believe at this point has not really been shown to be scientifically proven. Is that correct? I know there's studies out there.
That is correct. So it's a very confusing issue about what e-cigarettes can be used for. So before e-cigarettes came into existence, when we talked about smoking cessation, we meant people were quitting nicotine, right? Getting off all tobacco products. Now with e-cigarettes, sometimes you can say, well, it's smoking cessation, I'm switching to an e-cigarette, which by US regulation is considered a tobacco product and it's regulated by the FDA. But the term smoking cessation also has this historical meaning of getting off all nicotine. So there are many studies out there looking at how well e-cigarettes can be used for switching. So that's the term that has generally been accepted, meaning going from one tobacco product, combustibles, to another tobacco product, e-cigarettes. And we use the term switching to make the distinction between, you know, cessation of tobacco. There have been some small studies talking about e-cigarettes getting off all nicotine. But in general, those have really just been sort of like epidemiological studies, looking to see what people are doing with these cigarettes and do they eventually get off of all nicotine. Most of the studies have been looking at, the randomized studies have been looking at switching from combustibles to electronic cigarettes.
Yeah, a lot of that has led to one of our big campaigns was Quit, Don't Switch, because as you said, we know that a lot of people end up being either dual users or they continue to smoke regular cigarettes where they can and use e-cigarettes in environments where they can't use the traditional cigarettes. So I think we're on the same page there. The other big concern we have, again, as a public health organization, is the effect that the nicotine has on the developing brain, the adolescents, with the youth epidemic that's been out there. Can you talk a little bit about the science behind nicotine and its role in addiction, especially in that age group?
Yeah, absolutely. So the majority of cigarette, of regular cigarette users, people who are addicted to combustible cigarettes, to tobacco, use it, have started before the age of 20. And it's very, very small percentage that start after that age. I think easily less than 5%. And so there's something very unique about the developing brain and how it can be, how it's can be sensitized, or rather it's ready to be modulated by nicotine. And so that addictive aspect is more likely to happen in a younger brain. And the brain, you have still the synapses forming, it's very plastic. And so having this chemical come in, which the way nicotine works is that it increases dopamine in the pleasure centers of the brain. And so it gives you a positive a sensation, a pleasing sensation when you use nicotine. And so that causes people to want to do it again, or kids, to want to do it again and again. And then over time, you can, you'll become addicted. And so where your brain now says, oh, I need my nicotine. And so that seems to be more likely to happen at a younger age. And so that's why it's really important for kids to never start any nicotine product, whether it's combustible cigarettes or e-cigarettes. Even though we're talking about them as less risky products, it's going to be, you still become very easily addicted to nicotine at that age.
And my understanding of nicotine as a chemical is it is very addicting, one of the most addicting substances we know of, and even very small doses can lead someone to become addicted, especially in that young age group. Is that correct?
So I think, I'm not sure about studies have looked at different levels of sensitivity, but I think so a cigarette, I just want to bring up actually another difference, important point about difference between e-cigarettes and cigarettes. So cigarettes are generally aversive. If you never smoked a cigarette, it's not particularly all that pleasurable. It actually takes some work to become addicted to cigarettes. I mean, so people are in social settings, and that's when they use, hanging out with their friends, other people are smoking. And so it's a social thing. And so that's why you might smoke more cigarettes than you might be able to. And then you'll reach a point where you now have become, addicted, and that pleasurable sensation is now attached to that cigarette. And that's when you start to become a regular smoker. E-cigarettes are not aversive at all. So they come in many flavors, and there's no, that harshness doesn't exist of inhaling something that's hot and burning. And so it's easier to take in lots of more nicotine more regularly with an e-cigarette. So while I'm not aware of the data that shows it's easier to become addicted on an e-cigarette than a combustible cigarette, it just seems that all those things that are, that are aversive about combustibles don't exist with e-cigarettes.
Got it. I understand. And I guess the aversion, some feel that the role of menthol in many cigarettes has helped decrease that aversion and make it smoother, so to speak. And again, as a lung association, hopefully menthol being taken out of some of these cigarettes and devices will help them be less attractive in some ways. Do you find that to be scientifically based, or?
Oh yeah, yeah. No, it's very exciting for the FDA to announce that they're going to be doing some rulemaking to eliminate menthol from combustible cigarettes. Is really an important step. So menthol is very popular with kids, and exactly that, it makes it a less aversive, and also people who smoke menthol finding it a harder time to quit. And there are also they're in measures of addiction. They're also tend to have a higher level of addiction than non-menthol smokers. So it's really important to take that out of the marketplace.
And then getting back to nicotine again, as you mentioned, we're not sure about the sensitivity, but will your research look at whether or not there's a level of nicotine inhalation that does not lead to addiction? Is that something that scientifically is being looked at or
reached? Yeah, absolutely. So I think FDA also announced that they're thinking about, that they're planning to issue regulations about reducing nicotine in combustible cigarettes. And that's based on from some very solid data. This is actually studies that were supported by NIDA and the FDA, where they have, so we have these cigarettes which have different levels of nicotine in them. And the study, this is by the group of Eric Donny and Dorothy Hatsukami, led this study, and where they took these different levels of these cigarettes with different levels of nicotine, gave them to smokers, and then measured how much they would smoke over many weeks once they had these different cigarettes. And they were blinded. They didn't know what level of nicotine were in the cigarettes they were using. So they had cigarettes that were the normal nicotine levels and then went down to very, very low. And what was interesting is that when nicotine was reduced just a little bit, those individuals smoked more. So they were compensating. They, because you could smoke just a little bit more, you know, a few more cigarettes and you get your same level of nicotine. But once it dropped below a certain level, they didn't compensate anymore. So they seemed accepting of that reduced level of nicotine. And interestingly enough, at the end of the study, the people who were on they did sort of like a test quit. Okay, you know, try and quit for a period of time and let's see how that works. The people on the lowest levels of nicotine were actually more able to quit for this test period than people on regular nicotine cigarettes. So it suggests that if nicotine levels are reduced, it's going to help people quit combustible cigarettes, and chances are it's going to make them much less addictive. That is going to be, it would be really hard probably to get enough nicotine out of a combustible cigarette to become addicted.
Interesting. So in general, you know, we feel that tobacco products seem to be inherently dangerous if we're just as a group. But we know that the FDA is allowing companies to pursue what's called a modified risk tobacco product authorization. And that means they have to demonstrate reduced exposure or reduced harm. Do you think this is something we're going to see more applications for from the tobacco industry?
Well, yes. Short answer is yes. And So with FDA being able to regulate tobacco, which was part of the Tobacco Control Act passed in 2009, it really gave them a lot of power to move the field in a new direction. And so now they can review these products. And the interesting thing about tobacco is that, I mean, I know you know, and all our listeners know that half the people that smoke regularly will die due to using tobacco, right? And 480,000 people die every year due to tobacco, and even more people have disease due to tobacco. And so we want to get people away from using those products and it's in the combustible cigarettes, it's not the nicotine that is causing all that harm, it's the combustion, all those combustion products. And so the idea is that if you can get people, you can get products. So again, I've said this before, I just want to repeat it. What we really want are people to quit using tobacco products, right? And there are FDA-approved products to do that. But a lot of people can't quit. They find it very hard. And so we don't want to forget those people. And what we want to do is get them to use products that are much less risky. And so this modified risk tobacco product pathway that FDA has allows for the creation of products that consumers could then buy that will be less toxic than a cigarette. I mean, on the one hand, it's not pretty much not much more toxic than a cigarette, but we want to really move away from that product as best as we can. And so creating that authorization for, you know, reduced exposure or reduced risk, you know, allows the legal sale of products that meet those less risky characteristics.
Would this include the so-called heat not burn type of devices that put out emissions with heating the tobacco rather than burning the tobacco? Is there a scientific difference there?
Yes, it does. So those products, they don't burn the tobacco. They have tobacco leaf in them, but it's heated to a much lower temperature than the temperature of burning. And so the toxicants are at a significantly lower level. And so the heat not burn product that's out there, FDA did give a modified risk authorization to for reduced exposure. Interestingly, they didn't give it for reduced risk. So the exposure means that there's fewer toxicants that the user will be inhaling, but I believe reduced risk means that there's going to be less disease due to that. And so that's a higher standard. It's very easy to measure exposure because then you're just measuring what's in the smoke or in the aerosol.
Right. I also wanted to ask about the role that, I guess, the PATH study, the population assessment of tobacco and health study. I guess it's been around since about 2013 with different waves. Is that something that, or how do you think NIDA will be looking at those kinds of cohort studies to help regulate tobacco products like the e-cigarettes that we're talking about?
Right. So the population assessment of tobacco and health, the PATH study, is run through NIDA. It is supported. It's funded by the FDA Center for Tobacco Products. And exactly you said, it is a longitudinal study of Americans and are doing multiple waves. It started in 2013. And so it's like, I think it's waves every 2 years. So I think we're in wave 4.5 now. And what we don't know, even though we know a lot of information about tobacco use, we don't have as good a sense as we should is like, how does tobacco use change in individuals over time? So if you have kids, you know, what products do they start using? When do they start using tobacco regularly? Do they switch between products? What might make them stop quitting? And, you know, and this longitudinal data will really give us a better sense of causation, of knowing that this happened to this person, and then this, and then this, then this third event, and this fourth event. And so it really will teach us what are people actually using, how are they changed between products, and that will give certainly FDA a really good view of what's really going on with tobacco product use and how might they generate new regulations to address perhaps the most vulnerable individuals or the products that are, you know, the most attractive to use, or what products might help people quit.
We've covered a lot, very comprehensive approach to this. Is there anything particularly at NIDA that we haven't talked about that maybe you've been more involved with that discussed?
It's a high priority for NIDA to address smoking. So we're the Institute on Drug Abuse. You know, nicotine is an addictive substance. People are addicted to tobacco products. And so it's a major focus of NIDA to help people stop smoking. And so we have a lot of big focus on developing new treatments for smoking cessation, whether that is through medications or other devices or mobile apps, digital therapeutics. We're supporting all of those efforts. But you know, electronic cigarettes are clearly an important part of that landscape now. And it's really important for us to understand how can e-cigarettes be used in adult smokers to help them stop using combustible tobacco. And so we're funding a lot of research to understand why people use e-cigarettes or why they don't use e-cigarettes, and how might they move from combustibles to e-cigarettes. But we're also very interested and very concerned about youth use of e-cigarettes. So kids are using electronic cigarettes more than they're using combustible tobacco. And that's a big concern. But what we're learning more about, though, is what's happening to those kids over years, you know, longitudinally. How it seems actually a lot of kids are using it just to experiment with, and they stop using them after a couple of years, which is great news. Right. But what about those kids that are continuing to use them? You know, are they just using them as part of other tobacco products they're using them? Are there kids that are more at risk for becoming regularly addicted to nicotine? So we have a lot of those questions, and it's hard. And by getting the answers to those questions, we could then figure out ways to develop treatments or for FDA to develop new regulations that will, you know, reduce as much as possible nicotine use by kids, or help them, if they do become addicted to nicotine, to stop using.
Well, certainly you and your institute are at the heart of a lot of the Lung Association's efforts to promote lung health and prevent lung disease. I mean, tobacco control and tobacco products are key in that area. So again, I want to thank you for taking the time today, and good luck in furthering the research to make things better for all of us.
Well, thank you very much. And I certainly, I want to thank you and your organization also, because it's a group effort. We need everybody to focus on this, and no one organization can do it alone.
Very good. Well, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you again, Dr. Walton, for providing guidance and evidenced opinion on this highly discussed issue. We're interested to learn from his team at the NIDA in the coming years. In the meantime, be sure to subscribe and follow Lungcast on your favorite podcast platforms. There you can enjoy some of our previous discussions, including last month's conversation on climate change-associated health with Dr. Pranay Sabiri and Dr. Alan Greenwise. For additional news and insights into respiratory health, be sure to visit us at hcplive.com and lung.org. Until next month, I'm Dr. Albert Rizzo, reminding you that if you can't breathe, nothing else matters. So just take it one breath at a time.